Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. March 21st, episode number 39, A Veritable Smorgasbord. Welcome everyone, I'm Kevin England and this is the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. We are on the cusp of spring here in New Jersey, and I can't wait for the warm weather to move in. Spring is teasing us as the daffodils are poking through the sod, and our bees have been tantalized with their first few warm days to venture out and greet the world once more. I thought for this episode that I would bring you a veritable smorgasbord of topics, keeping in mind, of course, that some of you are here for the very first time, while others are like welcome friends back for another chat about beekeeping. This episode will mix up some pointers for the new and prospective beekeepers, and some insights for you veterans out there who have tuned in to find out some of the latest things going on in the world of beekeeping. Let's run down what we have in store for this episode, and then we'll turn up the wick and get down to business. Segment number one, a little spring preparation mixed in with a shot of getting started. Some basics on what should be going on this time of the season and some pointers for those tuning in who are looking for some insights on how to get started in beekeeping. Segment number two, we sat in on a session with Indiana beekeeper Tim Ives. For that, we'll hit the highlights. Segment number three, New Jersey State apiarist Tim Schuller ran through his summary of trends for beekeeping in 2012 and his preparations for 2013. We'll let you know some of the key points he shared and where you can get up to speed on all of the insights. For segment number four, one of our first summary reports from the content at the American Beekeepers Federation Conference, Clothie Anadin, the often-discussed neonic pesticide, a scientist finding about whether corn or soybeans pose a risk. Then we'll venture into roundtable, a shotgun review of various topics. For this go-around, we'll talk about the top bar hive construction process, the visit with the ABF honey princess, a swarm survey idea, the short talk on the Jersey Fresh branding program, and a few other topics. Yep, it will be, as we said, a veritable smorgasbord. How about we get to the first thing on the menu? The local hive report. For the local hive report, we take a little time to get you acquainted in the goings-on in our bee yard. We have three hives out on the property this year, and it is a good time for bees. Spring is just about to bloom. The grass is greening up, and you can see the crocuses are up, the snowdrops are up, and the daffodils are starting to push their buds through the sod, as we said a little bit earlier. The crocus bloom and the daffodils pushing through are 2 full weeks later than they were last year, according to our notes. And this is really more like a traditional start of spring here in New Jersey. Admittedly, all three hives are pretty light this time of year, but that's not to be unexpected given the experiment we were running for not feeding the bees over winter to see whether they would survive or not. I literally took a bathroom scale out and weighed up hive number one and number three to see what they physically weigh, and we'll watch their progress through the season as they rebound into spring for the nectar flow. In the configuration for hive one and three, they both have a PVC hive stand. They have two deep boxes on a bottom board that is screened. They have inner covers, outer covers. Both of them have a insulation box on them, and one of them has a feeder box that I've created. If you look at a general configuration of bottom board, two deeps, frames, foundation, just the standard stuff that you would get before you put bees in a box, it weighs somewhere around 50, 55 pounds. Hive number one at 100 pounds with a 10-pound rock on the roof. That shows you that there's not a tremendous amount of weight in there for the bees and the wax that's inside. Hive number three, weighing in at 70 pounds, is skinny light. I have to believe that that cluster in there is extremely small. But, you know, when we get a break in the weather, we'll go take a peek. I'm not really overly concerned about the status of our bees. This is not unusual to have a small cluster coming out of winter, and I've seen them ramp incredibly to the point where when they get to April, every frame is covered and the hives are busting with bees. It just seems to be the characteristic of these queens that we have, Cornolians, that came from Sukhobi, that they ramp down severely in the winter, and then they come back with a huge bang in the springtime. I have to be cognizant that I didn't feed them through my experiment that I've been doing. If you're not familiar with that, go back and listen to the last episode. And, I do believe, though, that we could declare victory at this point. Once they get that good first taste of foraging and they've been out on the crocuses and the foraging flowers, I have to believe that they now have a source of nectar. Skunk cabbage, some other things are out there in bloom. And we'll get some warm days in the next number of days. It was 45, 50 degrees yesterday, and our girls seem to be flying at 40, 45 and higher. So while I was at work yesterday, I have to believe that they were out and flying. So once we get to this stage of spring, and today is literally the first day of spring as I'm recording this, I think we're in the green light and we will forge ahead through to the spring nectar flow. So all three hives doing really well. One of the things I wanted to do for the local hive area is put my bear fence up and get that all sorted up. I really wanted to go clean up some of the vegetation around my area and make provisions for that, but life has gotten in the way, and I keep talking about this bear fence, and this year is going to be the year for it. I'm going to India for work very soon, and I think when I come back, I am going to have to make a concerted effort to get that plan going. So, local hive report, three hives doing okay. Rather late, we'll keep rather light, but we'll keep watching them, and if need be, late in the season, we'll feed them, but I think we have a green light to spring. Let's jump right into segment number one. What I'm going to talk about is back to basics and just simply getting started in beekeeping. We know this is the time of year where a lot of new beekeepers show up. Still a strong interest in beekeeping in New Jersey, according to state apiarist Tim Schuler. All of the beginning beekeeping courses on the books are being filled up rather quickly. You know, there's two ways to get into beekeeping, by serendipity or by design. You have to ask yourself, is this by whim or are you planning your entry into the beekeeping world? People who get into beekeeping by whim only get by so long, and then they find out that, well, you kind of need to know what you're doing. There's a moment of clarity that comes along that puts you in a position to face that you just can't wing it, no matter how much you love the bees or want to save the environment. That's a little bit of tough love for some people, and they wonder how they get themselves in a position of having to learn bee biology and what a varroa mite is and all of those things. They want it to be simple and warm and fuzzy. And all I have to say is, I'm sorry. I hate to be apologetic for that, but the fact of the matter is I encounter beekeeper after beekeeper in this situation at some of these bee meetings who show up and say, put them in the box and they're now not going to survive winter. What happened? You know, I'm not trying to discourage you if you showed up and you have that attitude. I'm just saying to you, the likely path that you're going to encounter is that if you're going to keep bees, there's a certain amount of rigor that is required to understand what's going on, to be able to roll your sleeves up and get the job done. I have the faith that a normal person, you don't have to be some special guru, can keep bees with very simple rules and get involved and have an enjoyable experience for it. But if you just believe that you're going to put them in a box and be able to harvest honey in July, that's generally not the principle. So I'm here to help. And how can I help? I guess if you are the planning guy, I'm your friend. If you are the serendipity type, well, I can help you there too. You see, I don't leave things to chance because I don't know who is on the other side of the line. I aspire to be complete, and I aspire to not leave anyone behind during the conversations that we go through on this podcast. And my friend says sometimes you have to take the time to spell things out, because as much as I understand, and I am still a novice, make no mistake about that, There are times when doggy, ducky, horsey are the right way to go. So we've written a guide about how to get started in beekeeping. And through the next series of podcasts, we'll bring you some insights. And I guess that means I'm going to have to do these more regularly. Otherwise, I can't come back to you in July with part two. Let me start with some sage advice provided by Tim Schuller. Was talking about him earlier. This is in the New Jersey Calendar. They had a guide for hive location tips for new apiaries. You want to locate your new location if you have one, or you want to relocate the one you have in a place where you have good flower and water sources. This is a time of year for the veteran beekeepers to put your water sources out and control where your bees are going. If you have a spot where you could set up a bird bath or some sort of water feature that the bees can use, remember they don't particularly like deep water. They don't want to get their feet wet. They want to stand on a pebble or a rock and sip from that versus having to wade into a pool or something like that. So this is the time to provide them a water source that's going to be warm. If you put a water source out in the shade and they have the opportunity to go to a warm spot on your neighbor's pool cover, they're going to go there for their water source and they'll never come back after you get it. So if you're a new beekeeper, pick a place where you have good forage and water sources. And if you're an experienced beekeeper, it's a good time to set that water source up. One of the things people often do is buy a bucket, put water in it, and float the little styrofoam peanuts that will never degrade, and the bees can land on the peanuts and walk down and drink in the water. Where you pick your apiary is important in the context that you want it to be in full sun, you want it to be out of a strong wind, and you want it to be able to get early sun. If you went out in the morning and stood in the place in your property or your bee yard where you hit that morning sun and it warms you up, that will warm the hive. And early warmth, early sun to your hive will mean early foragers and healthier hives. Hives do much better in full sun. In fact, that's the recommendation. It's not good for varroa mite, the pest varroa mite, and or small hive beetles to be in full sun hives. They prefer hives that are in the shade and they will create problems. So find a place where it dries out quickly after it rains, where the snow does not stand and it melts right away, and find a place where that morning sun hits first. You want it to be facing south and you want to be able to get that early warmth into the hive. Pick a spot where you can get your hives up off the ground. You could use a hive stand or put them on a cement block, but the key is do not set your bottom board down on the damp ground where the morning dew is going to be there. Moisture is not good for beehives. You want them to remain dry, and they will bring moisture and control moisture inside the hive. You do not want to facilitate a damp, cool place for the hives. If you're going to use a hive stand, try and keep it below 12 inches. Anything higher than 12 inches becomes a problem when you start to stack two deeps and supers on top and it's higher than your shoulders. It becomes a little bit difficult. And you certainly don't want to be using a ladder. So you want to try and get your hives up off the ground, but no higher than 12 inches for your hive stand. If you're in that area where there's a lot of wind all the time, we have neighbors who live up the road and sit on the hill crest. The wind is always blowing at their house. You would need to use a windbreak in that situation, especially when it's cold and windy. That's definitely something you're going to need to consider if that's a feature of your property. And last but not least, you want to put your hives in a spot where you can get to them easily to move equipment around, whether you use a garden tractor and you pull some sort of trailer, or you're using a yard cart or something like that. Even if you're driving your vehicle in, you want to be able to get to your bees during all kinds of weather. You don't want to put them in a place where they could wash away in the 30-year flood. People get very upset when these things happen. When you have a huge rainfall coming and you're dealing with trying to take care of your bees in an emergency situation, you don't ever want to get in there. But the other thing is put it in an inconspicuous place. Don't put it right on the edge of your property alongside your least favorite neighbor. out of sight, out of mind is the best rule of thumb. If you are going to put it somewhere near a property line, if you don't have a lot of space, be considerate to your neighbors, be considerate to passerbys. You do not want the main flight path of the bees to be flying over any populated area or any parking area. Bees do defecate when they do cleansing flights, and when they do, they will ruin paint on cars. People put them over their lines where they dry their clothes and wonder why they got all these spots and stuff on. So, you know, I'm being graphic to the point of explaining this to you so that you don't make those type of mistakes. Do give some consideration where you put your new apiary, or if you're moving your apiary to start a season, get some ideas there. Now, I mentioned before a getting started guide. You can go to our website, www.bkcorner.org, and look on the right side of the home page. These tips and others are available there. Anything you want to know about buying equipment, purchasing bees, things like that, you can go check out our guide. It's available in a PDF for you to download. Everybody should be able to pull that down. And also, we've recorded it in audio format if you want to listen to it that way. So getting started in beekeeping, this is the time when people start to look into purchasing bees. Really, you wanted to have placed your order earlier, but our best suggestion is get in local with somebody who's at a beekeeping association, join a beekeeping association, and get yourself situated that way, and they'll give you the best advice and guidance for getting your bees, getting your equipment, getting things started up, and you can get off to a good start for the 2013 if you're getting started. The other thing that you could do on a getting started basis is go take a beekeeping course. This is really a fast way to get yourself indoctrinated, and typically those things are taught by instructors who are geared with content for the new beekeeper. So, you know, invest in that. You will go far with that type of training. For segment number two, we're going to jump across to a different topic. Got an opportunity to see a special presentation. Tim Ives came out to New Jersey on the invitation of the Northeast New Jersey Beekeepers. Tim hails from Liberty, Indiana, and he drove all the way out and gave a presentation to a pretty packed room of folks who probably had no idea who Tim was, but I have been familiar with Tim. I saw his coverage in American Bee Journal, and also when I went to the ABF conference, there was some discussion about him. He's made many conversation points. I don't know how to say this. He's in the circle right now. A lot of people talking about it since his article was published. He had some time with Randy Oliver, who always draws a crowd wherever he goes. Tim's the kind of guy that's doing something a little bit different. No feeding, no pollen, no brood control. In the context, or no varroa control. He's just not following anybody's conventional wisdom. His expectation is that he's going to go with survivor stock. And the thing that Tim is most famous for is all of the pictures of his colorful hives stacked higher than his head, where he's standing on a big ladder trying to get to them, 6, 7, 8, 10 boxes high, leaning tower of pizzas. The thing that's interesting about the Tim Ives piece and what he's most known for is he lives in the Corn Belt. He's doing something that should not be possible, which is presenting his bees in an area where there's nothing but neonicotinoids and corn and soy. Now, one of the things about Tim, and he'll tell you, is he's near a grove of locust trees and he does have some forage area. And he's been through a considerable amount of losses through the years. He's become very smart from that. He's learned about varroa-sensitive bees. He's learned about working with survivor stock and splitting and, you know, basically taking care of things. But here's some of the philosophies, and it doesn't begin to scratch the surface of some of the techniques that he used. I was able to record Tim, and I really have to go back and listen to this 2-hour presentation. There was so much information mixed with the smattering of questions, and it's kind of one of those sessions that you have to listen to over and over again and hear the points and digest them and see if you can figure out what the secret sauce is for the way that Tim works. In a nutshell, one of the things he's most known for is a three-deep system. He winters his bees with three deeps. The concept of this is that you're going to have more bees in the box. More bees in the box means that they will be able to sustain the cluster better. They will be able to be a better workforce in the spring. And one of the things he does with his hives in the spring, they come out loaded with bees. And when they're loaded with bees, he takes an empty medium and he puts it over top. For the new beekeepers, boxes come in different heights. They're commonly referred to as a deep, a medium, and a shallow. The medium box that he puts over top of his three deep boxes is empty. It has nothing but frames that have foundation in them, no drawn comb. Over top of that, he stacks three, four, five boxes of drawn comb, medium-sized supers. Here's the premise to this, and we've covered this before on the podcast, but he's making it work, and I've read this in books, and he was describing the situation with a couple nuances that make this work and made me start thinking about this. One of the premises in the spring is when you have a large workforce, you want to put them to work. If they start to get crowded, they have the potential for swarming. If they have the opportunity, however, for stuff above them to load, that entices them to build. It entices them to build comb and entices them to go out and forage and pack every inch of that. The workforce in a hive can collect far more honey than what you can put in a box. They have the capacity for that. In this, the three deeps on the bottom are for the brood chamber, and that is where the queen factory is. She's going to continue to crank out bees. The foraging and nurse bees pretty much stay put down there. Right over top of them, you have the medium super with foundation only. The queen is not going to go up across that. That's the premise of this. But the forager bees are going to know upstairs in the penthouse there are open comb, and they're going to go up and fill these out. Now, this doesn't work if you put empty boxes above. And I know last spring I tried this approach, and for whatever reason, I didn't see my bees go crazy about all this extra space above. But Tim is saying that his bees go nuts. He has a huge workforce because he's doing three bees over winter, three deep boxes loaded with bees. He comes out with a bomb of a hive loaded with a huge workforce, and as soon as that nectar flow breaks, he's stacking all those boxes in the cold weather. Now, March, middle of March, is when he's putting his supers on. They haven't started foraging yet, but he's loading them up and getting them used to the idea that there's room in the penthouse. As soon as the nectar flow breaks and things start to green up and flowers start to go, these bees are going to go crazy and they're going to take care of all this. Now, let's go back to some of these previous episodes where we've talked about the Varroa problem and say, how does this work in that capacity? Why would this work? Well, one thing that happens with Varroa is you do not want the Varroa, which they incubate at a shorter life cycle than the bee. You don't want them to outpace the bees. Well, if the hive is thriving in the spring and growing and growing and growing bees, it is possible that they outpace the Varroa. The other aspect of this is with a high forage rate comes a shorter lifespan of the bee, and the bees are dying quicker and the rotation is happening quicker. Refresh of bees, right? The queen's laying more eggs and kept going, and the workforce is keeping pace with the Varroa mite growth. He's talking about selective stock. Over the years, he's chosen bees that are surviving the winter and surviving parasites and whatever. If he's getting to the point where he's not giving any sugar solutions, he's not giving any pollen supplements, and he's not treating for mites, it is possible that he's achieved an ultimate state of Varroa-sensitive hygiene in his stock that this is working for him. He was only picking those hives that survived. He does do a lot of splits. He sells a lot of bees, which at some point he went through this selling nukes. As we know, when you split the bees, you're giving away half your varroa. I don't know that he made a profession of this. He did indicate that it wasn't something he was overly interested in. But whatever the case, what fascinates me is the formula of three deep boxes coming out of winter. The aha moment of the empty box sitting right over the brood chamber. And then the capacity of having all the boxes up in the penthouse for ultimate storage space to pack away whatever you can. This somewhat reminds me of the Oscar Peron hive that I talked about, where the brood chamber is on the bottom. That's in a previous episode, probably 3 or 4 or 5 ago, where they build a thing in South America that the hive is locked up down on the bottom and they never go in it. Very similar premise here if you're doing it that way. And it is interesting to know that the queen is not going across. So I guess I'm repeating and rambling at this point, so I'll close it down. I'm going to go listen to his video and look for other nuggets and insights, but you can look for Tim Ives. There's a report on Randy Oliver's site, and you can also go to the Southeastern Indiana website. There's indianahoney.org. Back in February time frame, there was something on him. It's called Real World Beekeeping Happening in the Corn Belt. And this really does put an interesting twist on, well, what do you think? How is it that somebody who's in the heart of neonicotinoids and feeding in the soybean belt where all of these nasty, evil chemicals are, how is he doing this, thriving? I don't know. There is one sidebar. He made mention that he has a lot of locust trees in his area. I know from seasoned beekeepers that locust trees are very prolific, and when they bloom, there is a ton of nectar, and bees can really pack on the honey. Not surprised if they do hundreds of pounds and people can keep rotating. One of the descriptions he had during the course of his presentation was that you could literally take honey supers off, extract them, put them back on, and they'd be filled in no time. That's a characteristic I continually hear about people who have locust groves nearby. So, you know, to each his own. I will not disparage his process and his method. He's certainly there. And one of the things he said was fascinating is there's people literally right down the street from him that have been keeping bees the same way for a number of years and not showing success. Still losing a lot of their hives over winter. Still not getting the honey crop. And they're 5 miles down the road, 5 minutes down the road. And they drive past and they see what he's doing. And one by one, he's converting them in his area. If that's not a testimony to maybe he's onto something, then I don't know what it is. So my eyes are open and I will follow it. You know, on the ride home, Bob Kloss went with me out to the meeting. We were talking about how many honey supers we can wrestle up and put our hives this year. One of us, I guarantee it, will have a stack of 9 hives, 9 boxes by the time spring nectar flow rolls through here in New Jersey. So maybe we'll be able to tell you by the end of the season whether this is something that's going to work for us. I'm certainly fascinated. Incidentally, I wanted to call out to Jason Bruins. Jason is a listener of ours here on the podcast. And the day that I signed up to go see Tim, Jason sent a message saying, there's this guy you need to check out. And lo and behold, it was Tim. And that's kind of a little bit of serendipity, but pretty cool. And thanks, Jason, for the tip. You know, I keep saying your name, and I'm not sure whether I'm getting it right, and you probably have told me how to say it, and I have to go back and look through my notes, but anyway, you know who you are, and thanks for the heads up on that, and apparently he knows you. I asked him if he had ever come across, and he was familiar with you, at least he thought he knew you, so there you go, Jason. Thanks for the heads up on that. Keeping things moving right along, next up, Tim Schuller's been in the news a lot lately. It seems that when he's not full-blown beekeeping inspecting during the summer. He is able to make the rounds, and he spoke recently at a beekeepers meeting about the 2012 trends, 2013 objectives. Let's just hit some of those highlights. The first thing, New Jersey winter death loss, treatment and non-treatment statistics. The death loss over the last number of years, 2009, 34, 2010, 35%, 2011, 31%, 2012, down to 21%. I would like to hope that that has something to do with smarter beekeepers in New Jersey, but it is possible that it had to do with the mild winter last year, I'm not going to lie. The average over the last 4 years has been 30% in New Jersey. He shared one other set of statistics. In 2011, those who did some form of treatment had 18% death loss. No treatment, it was 65% lost bees. In 2012, the numbers are adjusted a little bit. Those who did treatment, only 17% reported some sort of death loss. But the non-treaters, it was 44%. I'm not sure what to read into those numbers, but that's the information presented. Tim mentioned the uptake in small hive beetles. He believed, as we were talking about in past episodes, much more of a problem last year due to the mild winter of 2012. Also noted an uptake in bear problems. Seemed to be more problems outside the hunting zones, and they were seen in various places in New Jersey that they haven't been seen in before or not for a long time. He showed an interesting picture of a swarm hive 30 days after the swarm was captured, and when they were looking in the drone brood, it was loaded with varroa. One of the common misconceptions is that when a swarm takes off from a hive, it doesn't necessarily have any problems with varroa mite after it lands wherever it's going. Fact of the matter is, it is very possible for them to bring varroa mite with them if there's a high infestation. And as soon as a queen starts to lay, 8-9 days into the cycle, their mites are going to crawl off the phoretic bees, meaning the ones they're hitching a ride on, and go into the cells, and within 30 days you'll have an infestation. So don't believe it if anybody tells you that there is not a possibility for swarm hives to have a varroa mite problem in short order. I hinted at this in the last episode, and Tim brought it out to the public, that they're working on a beekeeper ordinance, a uniform beekeeper ordinance that can be shared with municipalities. I think it's not a secret, with the explosion of beekeeper interest over the last number of years since the CD has been popularized, that municipalities are struggling with an influx of new beekeepers and confrontations. What Tim was trying to achieve, and working with the executive board of the NJBA and his offices at the New Jersey Department of Agriculture, is to prepare a model ordinance so that if someone is considering some means by achieving control over beekeeping in a municipality, they can have some reasonable guidelines. And hopefully the NJBA, the NJDA, Department of Agriculture, will support it. And this is an example of beekeepers working together, which was one of Tim's themes throughout his presentation, is that we've made a lot of strides in New Jersey by the beekeeping community being actively engaged. The New Jersey Department of Agriculture recently pulled in some folks who could do some testing. Typically, they had always sent everything that they wanted to test down to the Beltsville lab in Maryland, and now they have a little bit of an in-house lab, and they were trying some sort of Nosema study. It wasn't an official study, but they were doing something to get their feet wet. They were monitoring levels. One of the things you always hear for treating Nosema is use fumigelin, and there's a question out there as to whether lemon juice could be substituted for fumigelin, do an adequate job, and not be as harmful as fumigelin is to the bees. They set up three groups of hives: fumigelin, a lemon juice, and a control with no treatments. And they did treatments through June of 2012 and August of 2012, and track the results. Again, not a huge scientific study, not something being done by a research, but something anecdotal that they could have a glimpse of how this was going to work. The results for the Fumagillin, they took a pretty big nosedive right after in the Fumagillin spores, and then within a certain amount of time, they just turned around and went right back up to where they started from. So not something that was overly effective over a long period of time. The lemon juice samples started medium to high and went down, stayed down low, and then did the same pattern, started to rise up to about where they started, but seemed to plateau a little longer in keeping the spores down. One of the questions that was asked repeatedly was, how was it administered? They put it in sugar syrup, I believe, and the ratio was 3/4 cup of lemon juice per gallon of solution fed to the bees. The controls, as you could imagine, with no treatment, two hives died right away, and the control hives just gradually increased in spores until they were off the charts. Just sugar syrup only for them. So the conclusion is, it looks like there might be something to this lemon juice or acetic acid principle, and they would love to conduct a scientific study with enough colonies to be statistically significant in this for 2013. That might be one of the targets that they're going to do. Now, Tim also participated in the National Honeybee Survey. They surveyed 24 apiaries across the state. To qualify for this, you had to have 10 colonies in your apiary, and you had to fit some sort of criteria that made you high risk. And that means you were a commercial, you were a queen producer, nuke producer, a pollinator, or you did migratory beekeeping. So far, the only data that they have is from the pollen samples that were collected. 10 apiaries in New Jersey were sampled. 20 pesticides were found in the New Jersey samples. In each of those samples, 2 to 11 pesticides were found in each of the samples. You know, I guess the question is, when they looked at this, given the parts per billion levels, how high is bad for the bees? That's an interesting question that is hard to determine at this point, and I don't know that there's any real rule of thumb on that. Some of the more common questions from the audience is, which pesticides were found, what concentrations. Tim didn't have the data with him, but he does have the data, and I guess at some point when the rest of the analysis comes out, not just the pollen, he'll make more of this public. But you know, you see all of these studies going on in the USDA for different things. It's fascinating to know what's going on, at least for us New Jerseyans, right in our own home here. 20 pesticides found in New Jersey samples, anywhere from 2 to 11 in our hives. I guess that's not much of a surprise, given what I've heard other samples. That seems to be relatively routine. The million-dollar question is, what concentrations, and was it bad enough to be sublethal, and some of those other questions. I guess we'll have to wait for the full study to come back in order to be able to gauge that. Another topic that Tim touched upon was common mistakes that he saw made by beginners. So if you're a beginner, take out your notepad. They don't feed enough in large volumes. When you set up a beehive in the beginning, you have to feed those bees like crazy in order to get them through to a state where they have enough bees to overwinter. Number one objective for the first year, get the bees to overwinter. It's not about collecting honey. You want to be able to feed that queen and grow enough stores that you have a massive workforce. People will feed cups of bees or cups of sugar to bees. They'll put a Boardman feeder, which is a mason jar. You want to feed gallons to the bees in the beginning. You want them to have as much sugar as they can process. So one of the things that they need in order to draw out wax comb is a proper amount of pollen and sugar solution. So whenever you put that first package of bees on, or you put the nuke in the box, you have to feed them out, and they need to build all the comb across till they're crowded in the bottom box, put a second box on them and keep feeding them all summer. Another thing that's routinely questioned is how people inspect their hives. They don't check to make sure the queen's in there and she's doing well. And you cannot judge the health of a hive by watching them fly. Are you watching the real bees fly, or are you watching another hive rob out what's left of your hive because you haven't done anything with them? As a new beekeeper, we always say this, you have our permission to be up to your shoulders in bees. You know, some people will give you different answers. You should leave the bees alone, you shouldn't be bothering them. As new beekeepers, it's your job to get in, keep an eye on the hive, watch what's going on. You'll do very little harm by working more in the bees than by leaving them to their own devices and have something go wrong right under your nose and you're completely oblivious to it. We talked about another factor that Tim raised, which is poor placement of the hive. Don't put them in the shade. They need to be in full sun. Pick the right location of that. That is really important. We say this over and over again, the small hive beetle and varroa do not tolerate very hot environments. And when the sun is full on, it will not harm the bees, but it will keep the tolerance level of the mite. When it's so hot, the mite starts ceases to reproduce when it's cold and when it's extremely hot. So full sun, folks. And then the biggest mistake of all new beekeepers is just don't treat for mites. We'll say it here every episode, I think. I'm pretty consistent about it. At least for New Jersey and the Mid-Atlantic region, it may differ for you. July and August is when you have to treat your bees. You have to make sure that you get the mites down. If the mites are in your hive at that time period, what's going to happen is they're going to bring parasites and make sick bees, sick environment inside the hive. And those number of bees that are built, the rotations of cycles, three of them, to the first frost, will be compromised with sick bees, and sick bees do not survive the winter. Treat for your mites in July and August, monitor them through the remainder of the year, and make sure you have the healthiest, biggest workforce you can going into fall with the adequate stores of pollen and honey, and you will be rewarded. There were other couple points, but there's one other misnomer that I want to call out explicitly, and that has to do with not using a smoker. There's some sort of new thing going around, don't use a smoker, and it's really not a good idea, especially if you're in a populated area. You want to smoke the bees, you want to mask the pheromone. It's going to calm them down. It's going to mask the alarm pheromone so that they do not attack you. It's more comfortable for you as a beekeeper, and it's more quiet to work the bees when they're not at your face all the time. Some people aspire to use sugar water solution sprays. If that works for you, fine. But at the bottom line is, if you're in an environment where the bees are not cooperating and you're not using a smoker, you're making a mistake. Get your smoker out. Use it properly. Don't gas the bees. That's another question you always get. How much do you use? A puff here, a puff there. You see them up on the frame. You manipulate them, push them down a little bit. You don't have to smoke the whole hive to the point where they're exiting the hive because you've put so much in there. But, you know, a judicious amount of the right smoke applied will make your beekeeping inspections so much better and enjoyable. So as always, Tim has a lot of insights and no loss for things that he brought. There were several other topics on this. At the end of this episode, we'll go through a place where you can go and catch up on the full presentation from Tim Schuler and the other presentations that happened on the day that he spoke. We'll cover that off in the roundtable, but that's a reasonable amount of factoids from the Tim Schuler Trends in Beekeeping for 2012 and Plans for 2013. And as always, we thank Tim for his service. We are truly blessed in the Garden State to have Tim, Bob Hughes, and others at our service in the beekeeping world. They are the best. Moving on to segment number 4. At the ABF conference, I attended a talk on clothianidin exposure levels from bee-collected pollen and nectar in seed-treated corn and canola plantings. It was presented by Colin Henderson, who had Jerry Brumenshank and David Fisher in the audience helping him out, and they were involved in the study. These three, I believe, are from different companies, Colin being from BLR Technology, Brumenshank being from the University of Montana, and David Fisher being from Bayer Crop Science out of North Carolina. The sessions weren't so formal that they introduced the people and where they came from. I kind of looked these people up, and to the best of my ability, I believe that's who they are. The field studies were conducted in cooperation with Bayer Crop Science. Bayer AG, the parent company, I'm assuming, along with Takata Chemical Industries, developed the clothianidin pesticide, which is a neonicotinoid and is manufactured under the trade name Gaucho. This talk was presented as part of the American Bee Research Conference, one of the work streams at the ABF, and it was organized by the American Association of Professional Apiculturists. The title of the talk was Exposure Levels from Bee Collected Pollen and Nectar in Seed-Treated Corn and Canola Plantings. The results presented were a result of a series of field studies that began in 2010 and commenced in 2011. The researchers were looking at field exposures of free-flying honeybees to clothianidin in seed-treated corn and canola. It started with 23 fields in Illinois and Indiana. They placed the bees around the fields while controlling flight overlap and collected pollen from the hives that were deployed. They also collected pollen directly from the corn plants during mid to late tassel in this 2010 time period and examined the pollen as it came for the plant for concentrations of clothianidin. To be clear about the flight overlap, basically they placed the bees far enough apart that they weren't foraging on the same crops, is what I gather from that. In 2011, they did a second round of this study on 30 sites in Nebraska. For the 2010 study, they used local bees in Illinois and Indiana. For the 2011 study, they trucked the bees in from Montana. As with the 2010 study, the 2011 corn study, they collected pollen from the hives via pollen traps and took the pollen directly from the corn on different intervals. They pointed out two different approaches between the collections that to me seem relevant, so I'm going to call them out. In the 2010 Illinois-Indiana research, the product used on the corn was Poncho 500. I said before it was Gaucho. Wonder why I have a conflict on that. For the 2011 Nebraska study, the product was Poncho 1250. There's a difference in the concentration of the clothianidin product in the seed covering for each of these products, and the final tally of their results, they applied a multiplier to the 2010 data so that the direct comparisons could be made when they did the follow-up analysis. So I'm no scientist, and I can't vouch if this is a sound science practice to use a multiplier. I'm not here to challenge the assumptions. My goal is to share the information as it was presented and just ask you to keep that in mind. So in summary, they used 53 colonies to collect the data, and they also took tassel pollen from the corn plants directly. What they also did, and I'll get to this later, is they sampled 30 fields with commercial colonies in Alberta, Canada. There, they were looking for nectar and pollen during early, mid, and late pollination periods for the canola. All the work was performed with documented good laboratory practices, and it's basically a statement that says they followed GLP proper scientific practices in handling the samples, something that would stand up against scrutiny by pure scientists if it came under review. The mean concentration in the pollen collected from the hives was 1.2 parts per billion. This is relatively low concentration of clothianidin corn residue, according to Mr. Henderson. Now comes an interesting point in the conversation. They did a survey of how much of the forage area was comprised of corn on the average in a study. The finding from aerial reconnaissance was that 72% of the foraging habitat for the bees was corn. In other words, of all the area that they could forage for product, 72% of the landscape was covered with corn. However, when they looked at the average of corn pollen grains in the samples collected versus other types of pollen, they found that the concentration was 19%. The net-net of this is that while the predominant food available to them was corn pollen, only 1 in 5 grains of pollen found in the samples was corn, and that's about 20% or so. This serves to demonstrate that when they have a choice, bees will pick other sources first and then go for the corn pollen. Bees are significantly underusing corn pollen in those settings, is what Henderson had said. So what about the concentration in the tassel pollen collected? The finding was that it was 4.4 parts per billion, which they expressed as being in the normal range of concentration for what should be in the tassel pollen at the plant. Now let me switch gears and speak about the data for the canola studies. They performed the same type of studies on canola, and unlike the corn pollen, bees do use canola more so, as 41% of all the samples had 100% pollen as canola pollen. So out of all the pollen samples they collected, many of the hives, 41%, had nothing but canola pollen. The pollen concentration of clothianidin residue was 1.7 parts per billion, or just a touch higher than the corn. For the canola nectar samples, the concentration of clothianidin residue was lower, and it was less than 1 part per billion. I think it was 0.8, if I have that correct. So the pollen concentration in the corn on average for clothianidin was 1.2 parts per billion. The concentration in canola was 1.7 parts per billion. The nectar was 0.8 parts per billion. One thing that they noted for the canola, they didn't mention this in the corn, is there was no statistical difference throughout the pollination period for the products. The concentration of parts per billion remained pretty much steady throughout the season, whether it was early canola, mid canola, or late canola in the season. So canola, by the sheer fact that they use it more than pollen, provides more risk, but the parts per billion total were expressed as not very concerning. I guess the takeaway for me in this session is that corn pollen is not that attractive, and if the bees have a chance, they'll use something else. But when it's canola, they're going to take it. I took a moment to go back and look at a study I was familiar with, the CAP project, which is the Coordinated Agricultural Project. I forget what CAP stands for, but it's basically the group of people that got together after CCD was discovered and decided that they were systematically going to divvy up the research required and cooperate for studying the CCD phenomena. And I learned of something from Mary Ann Fraser, who is one of the CAP people, at a talk I went to, where she recalled that she showed data about concentration of pollen samples. I went back and looked at my notes from a year or so ago, and what it had in hers was that the highest collected parts per billion for clothianidin was 2.6 parts per billion, which is higher than this study. I seem to recall, but I hope I'm not misquoting that, that Marianne had shared an opinion that clothianidin was not a problem, imidacloprid, which is a cousin to clothianidin, was not a problem at that parts per billion. The problem with her study was that there were very small, minute hives that had imiclopurate in it. I think I'm saying that right. And the concentration of that product was extremely high and extremely toxic to the bees, but that's not really relevant here. And again, that's all from memory, so I hope I seem to recall it right. But again, if I look at the reference to that, I don't recall in my notes Marianne calling out 2.6 parts per billion for clothianidin being a big deal. So given that this is 1.2 and 1.7 respectively, I think we're in a good way here. I'd like to provide a source for you to listen to this directly, but unfortunately, I don't see this recording up on the ABF website. I seem to believe that they did record this, but maybe I'm wrong about that. Either way, I hope you found this information informative and interesting, and I would encourage you to go take a look out there. There seems to be a lot of different studies about concentration of clothianidin in corn. I found four or five of them on Plus One. The funny thing is most of those that I looked at seem to have higher concentrations, but I did not take the time in my cursory looks at those to see how they actually tested all this. Whatever the case, that was what was reported this year from a current study, and again, I hope you found it informative and interesting. It's time now to roll into the roundtable section of our podcast. This is just random topics in no particular order. We'll start with the first one, Top Bar Hive with a Twist. If you've been following along on the podcast, you know that I am working to build a top bar hive. And one of the things I did was alter the dimensions so that the length and width would fit Langstroth boxes on the top. I'm sure that this is not a novel idea, and I've seen pictures of this on the web. One of the difficulties with the approach that I took was that I used old wood that's been laying in the garage. Rejected wood from hardwood floors, nice oak pieces, tongue and groove. It makes a beautiful appearance, but one of the difficulties is some of these were banana boards. They had a twist to them, both down the length of the board and through. I tried to pick the best pieces when I put it together, but the byproduct of this is that some of the pieces that I had a little bit of twist and warp. Well, I got all done, stood back, admired the work, went and got some boxes, put them on top, and lo and behold, they wobble and they shake and they move all over the place. I guess I'm going to have to be satisfied with a top bar hive that does not have the ability to put boxes on the top. It's not the end of the world. I was thinking of compromise ways where I could build a shim to make up for the holes, but I don't want the boxes to be sitting on top, wobbling back and forth, and I'm certainly not going to take it all apart. I guess I'm going to have to look at the mantra of these top bar hives, which were, don't fuss over them. I've fussed way too much over this. It's almost like a boutique hive. That's just my nature, folks. You should know that by now if you listen in. So I'm a little disappointed that my vision of being able to put boxes and overwinter things and take the warmth of the top bar hive and put nukes over top and all that is not going to work out, but it's not the end of the world. Either way, when you stand back and look at the hive, it's very nice. Have to build the roof for it. I'm still trying to noodle about how I'm going to do that, but the rest of it seems pretty good shape. Tell you, you underestimate sometimes when you get out in a wood shop how much time it takes. A lot of hours invested in this, more than I want to admit, but at the end of the day you'll see the pictures and hopefully you'll appreciate the effort that we put in to build a top bar hive and learn a little bit more about natural beekeeping. The next roundtable topic is a swarm survey idea. I was listening to the Michael Bush recording that I made not too long ago, and Michael was talking about one of the things as a beekeeper you have to understand is when the swarm season comes to your area, you should do your preparatory steps. It got me to thinking that I recall collecting a swarm on May 1st one year, but when is swarm season? That's a really good question. And that made me go to a bigger thing of, you know what, wouldn't it be neat if somebody had empirical evidence collected about when people started to capture swarms somewhere in the state of New Jersey? A phone call to the state apiarist, no such data exists, and the proposal is born. Sent a message over to the New Jersey Beekeepers Association asking them if they would distribute some information, and we're going to collect 4 data points, and I am going to survey this and put it up on a website somewhere with a tool that will map out where the swarms were captured. So we asked, what's the street address? Hopefully a number, a street, and a town. Some people may want to use discretion about disclosing where swarms are. I'll take a town, that's reasonable enough. How big was the swarm? Small, medium, or large? Small is something grapefruit size or smaller. Medium is grapefruit to basketball size. And larger is larger than a basketball. Where was the swarm in a height standpoint? Can you reach it from standing height? Do you have to use a ladder to get it? Or is it higher than a ladder? One of the stipulations is you don't have to actually capture the swarm. It's just a matter of if you see one and report it, that would be useful information. The other obvious one is the date of it. And in combination, you could take all of those things and plot them on a map, and using color code, you could figure out when swarm season hits. We'll do this for 2013, and then if it works out really well and we get some reasonable data, maybe we'll do it for 14 and 15, we'll start to build a data set that we can count on for when swarm season goes. If you think about how New Jersey works, typically things happen in the south first. I'm curious to see if that trend is real, and I guess when we have data points about swarms, perhaps we'll find out some interesting patterns in the data. So propose that, and we'll see how that goes through the 2013 beekeeping season. At the late winter New Jersey Beekeepers Association meeting, they had a speaker there talking about Jersey Fresh. This is a program, if you're not familiar with it because you're not from New Jersey, where they label produce and products in New Jersey with the Jersey Fresh logo. Fascinating discussion the speaker had about how this evolved. At first, it was basically just a branding thing, and it really didn't have any substantive value. They were just saying that products from New Jersey were really good, put a Jersey Fresh logo on it, and people could appreciate that things like famous New Jersey tomatoes versus Idaho potatoes. New Jersey is very well known for our tomato products here. That being said, they started to discover that they really wanted to get a better identity, so they invested some funding in putting the program together to do not really a certification, but something a little better than that, just it's from New Jersey program that they had. They do kind of set standards and guides for what it means to label something as Jersey Fresh. And you can subscribe to the program through a nominal fee and use the Jersey Fresh, and as long as you follow their guidelines, they don't necessarily inspect you, but they will check up on you if it's necessary. And in essence, Jersey Fresh has become a true brand that people appreciate. I know when we go into our local grocery store and we see the Jersey Fresh logo, we know that the products are coming from here. And with the local movement that runs across the United States, a lot of people are trying to build local. So the Jersey Fresh logo and branding carries even more weight in this day and age. So anyway, interesting presentation on that. And what I'm going to do is give you a tip. You can go to the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association site that I manage, and all of the presentations from that day are posted up there. You can listen to the New Jersey Fresh presentation that I just mentioned. Tim Schuler's presentation that I talked about a little bit earlier is up there. We had a visit from, I think it might have been her first public visit, the American Beekeeping Federation Princess, recently crowned. Emily Campbell was there. She did a presentation, and we had a talk from her. I also had a chance to interview her and put her information up on our YouTube channel. That interview was pretty cool. Farmland assessment, I don't know how this works across the world, but in New Jersey, farmland assessment is a big deal. You can use your apiary as a potential means for getting farmland assessment, which gives you a discount on your taxes. Jeff Bird, the second vice president of the New Jersey Beekeepers Association, is also a tax assessor in Ewing Township, New Jersey. He gave a talk that day, and his presentation is up there. You can listen to that if that's of interest, and a couple other things. There was a bear seminar given that day, and we're looking to find permission to put that up. Hopefully we can get that cleared, but you can give that a listen. If you go to our homepage, nwba.njbeekeepers.org, there's a feature on the homepage as this is being released. At some point, there'll be a more prominent link to it so it doesn't get lost. It'll probably be put in an archive feature there. You'll also see on our site the swarm survey and some of that. We also have another feature on that website that we're doing, and maybe if you're a New Jersey beekeeper and you hear this, you can give me some tips. What we'd like to do, often I get asked, oh, I went to see Michael Bush. Oh, I went to see Tim Ives. Well, how did you learn about that? What we're trying to do is we learn that someone's going to be speaking somewhere in the tri-state area. We'll post that out there. Currently, the only one that I know of is Deb Delaney is coming, and her link is up there. But if you know of any other beekeepers coming to speak, whether it's a local branch meeting or somewhere in the New Jersey tri-state area, Philadelphia, Delaware, upper New York or lower New York or whatever, let us know, and we'll post it out. We'd be happy to have the information. One other thing along the lines of the Northwest New Jersey is we had a recent session for Products of the Hive, and put that up there. Alf and Seal Berg from Herbertsville Honey were in town for us. They came over and did a special presentation, and Seal demonstrated how they make candles, and they made some products, hand cream and so on. So that video is available up there. It's also on our YouTube channel. Might as well give you the YouTube channel. You can go check out our videos we've been posting still through the winter time. And it's youtube.com/NWNJBA. One other thing that we brought back retro on our website while I'm at it. Bob Kloss, our current president, when he was a vice president, did a presentation on drone brood removal. If you listen to our last episode, you heard my epiphany that I believe that drone brood removal, in the premise of removing drone brood and getting rid of varroa mite and solving the varroa problem to some extent, is back in favor, and I am really thinking hard about going back into that. Bob did a presentation, a great presentation, and the audio is up there along with the PowerPoint that he used to discuss the topic. If you're not familiar with that, and you want to understand the premise of using drone brood culling to control your varroa mite, you can go check that out too. That's out on our NWNJBA website. I listened to it the other day, and I was joking with Bob this afternoon about how I like our personalities in our club. We have a lot of neat people, a lot of interesting beekeepers, and throughout that you can hear the different personalities and dynamics of our interactions in there. That's just a personal sidebar, but always nostalgic to go back and listen to some of our meetings. Bob was making a comment about that guy, Randy Oliver or something. He didn't know who he was. And now, of course, we all know who Randy Oliver is. He's a very prominent beekeeping biologist, scientist, whatever he refers to himself as. Incidentally, I'm kind of all over the place, but I'll just keep my stream of consciousness going. On the abfnet.org website, the American Beekeeping Federation, for the conference that I referred to earlier, there are recordings out there, and one of the good ones is Randy Oliver. Now, I've heard Randy speak 2 times last year, and he's updated his presentation, and it's a do not miss. There's a lot of really insightful new information from Randy. And if you have the time and you're not listening to me, please Go on over there and find Randy Oliver and listen to his presentation. It is worth the price of admission, which is free, by the way. Do go check that out. I guess I'm coming to the close here. I'm a little over an hour. Wanted to bring one other tidbit for you, a little insight for you, and you could use this trivia to impress your beekeeping friends. You know, it's always been a mystery as to why bees do washboarding on the landing board. If you've ever seen this behavior, you'll see a bee just scooting back and forth, forward and back and forth. I was listening to a recording recently, and someone gave a clue as to what that was, and I'm buying it hook, line, and sinker. When a bee goes out and picks up propolis and brings it back to the hive, the sticky resin that they get from trees, which they use to seal the hive, coat the hive, and in some instances, people scuff the inside of their hives so it gets layered with propolis, which is a bit of an immunity system for the hive environment. That immunity thing is the key to washboarding. What someone once said is that these bees are out there scrubbing the entrance of the hive, moving back and forth, and they're rubbing off the propolis residue on their bodies, and they're basically burnishing and cleaning the front entrance so that when bees are coming back from foraging, they're landing on a pristine environment and coming through into the hive. And that is why they'll clean near the entrance, and they'll clean the landing board, and they'll be scrubbing back and forth. The hypothesis is here is that they're actually laying down a micro layer of propolis. And I think that's kind of cool. I never thought of that. And that makes, it makes sense. I hope it's true. Or I'm spreading folklore here, but I thought that was a pretty neat explanation of that. So I guess that's it for Roundtable. I can't recall anything else that I wanted to stick in here. Actually, wait a minute. Yes, I do have one more thing. In New Jersey, one of the training classes that happens for new beekeepers is taught by the Rutgers Extension, and they hand you a book called Beekeeping Basics. It's from Marek, and it is a great resource written out of Penn State. This is my guidance to you. New beekeeper or seasoned beekeeper, and I think I've made this recommendation, but given this is the time of year we see new beekeepers, go get this book and give it a read. I've read a bunch of different guides. I've written my own Getting Started in Beekeeping guide, which I talked about earlier in the episode. But in that context, this is one of the best fundamental books that I've ever seen. Sharon, my wife, went to the beginning beekeepers class and came home with this. And I've read it over and over again. And oftentimes when I want to get grounded, I go back and read it. Now, the thing is a little bit old. I don't know actually when it was written. I'm going to guess 2006, 7, 8, something like that. But it's still very relevant and very sound research in here. It's called Beekeeping Basics, and it's by Marek. M-A-A-R-E-C. If you go to Bing or you go to Google and you look it up, you can find the PDF from Penn State University. And you will be able to pick that up free of charge. Marek is the Mid-Atlantic Apicultural and Extension Consortium. They've been a little bit dormant lately. I've been trying to poke someone to try and get them to go back in. I think Marianne Fraser is a principal there. Or maybe it's Deb Delaney that I mentioned earlier. But I would love to see them get active again. It seems like maybe it's just me and I'm oblivious. But let me come back to task here. Beekeeping Basics, Marek, Delaware, Maryland, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and the USDA cooperating. That's what's on the cover. It's Beekeeping Basics in yellow. You see a swarm on the left-hand side, a bee on a flower on the right-hand side, and the bottom right has a queen with her court around it. It has a Penn State logo on the front. I looked it up on Bing. Beekeeping Basics, Marek, M-A-A-R-E-C, and it came up as the first link. It's a PDF file, and it is definitely worth the look. So I'll leave you with that. I want to thank you for listening to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. If you want to contact us, send a note. You can reach me at kevin@bkcorner.org. You can leave us a voicemail on our phone number, 609-460-4037. Our website is bkcorner.org. Typically, you'll find show notes. And this is a little tip that I don't know that I've ever shared with anybody. Many people have not been to our webpage. Every episode, we put the time for every segment. If you want to find out when I spoke about Tim Schuller's presentation, you can go to the website, find that it started at, 11:39 in the presentation or whatever. That's there for almost all of the episodes that we've recorded thus far. This is number 39, which astounds me that we've gotten that far. And anyway, let me close it there. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Bye, everyone.